720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you. Lamont Black is an associate professor of finance in the Dry House College of Business at DePaul University here in Chicago. He is also the academic director for the Center for Financial Services. He previously was an economist at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors in D.C. Lamont, thank you so much for coming back on with us this week. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Matt.
Okay. So last week you tried to educate us on Bitcoin, and I tried to come along. Now, to take our minds off of Bitcoin, we have the whole craziness with GameStop. Now, here's what I know about GameStop. We have gift cards to GameStop because I have kids and we have video games. And then all the GameStop stores are like closing. So you better like get your stuff, order online or whatever, because those gift cards aren't going to be great anymore. That's what I remember about GameStop, is like that's a dying business. But on Reddit, which is, I guess, just like an internet chat forum type thing, you'll hopefully explain that a little bit to me. There was a guy posting his something called Roaring Kitty, and he was big on GameStop. For whatever reason, he had put $53,000 into GameStop a couple of years ago, and then over and over again was talking about GameStop and GameStop and GameStop. And suddenly, his $53,000 bet on GameStop from a couple of years ago had soared in value to $48 million. I'm reading the New York Times articles on him and kind of what happened here. I still don't quite understand what is going on. Basically, and jump in wherever you want, but basically, this guy was all high on GameStop. It sounds like he actually had his reasons to think this stock was going to come up. And so he bought GameStop, and then he's, you know, he's got friends online. He started out with like a few YouTube followers, but somehow he's just built this weird group of people that love him and think this is fun and whatever. And so they start investing in GameStop because he loves it. And things happen that the price goes up a little bit for him here and there, and he's making money. So then other people are jumping into GameStop, and it keeps going. And then they find out that some brokerages are betting against GameStop, that they know that, well, this company doesn't really have a lot to go on, but this guy's propping it up, so let's bet against it. And then this group found out that there's people betting against them, so then they kind of got mad and, I guess, poured even more money into it, or got people to, so that these brokerages that were, I believe this is short selling, would get burned by the fact that the price was not going to go down. Is that, in essence, what's going on here? And if not, can you please explain to me what's going on here?
Yeah, no, I think you did a pretty good job. So, I think it's ironic that we were talking about cryptocurrency last week, which now seems tame in comparison to the stock market this week. So this has certainly been a wild ride. And my students are all over this.
I'll bet.
They've been asking me about GameStop all week. And I think part of why this is in the news is also just many of us are familiar with GameStop for the reasons you gave. You know, it's a retail store that many of us have shopped at. But the stock price this week has really been incredible because, you know, this is a company, like you said, that was basically going out of business. People thought it was kind of like the next blockbuster, yeah. You know, a retail store that's now going into this online type of e-commerce, and it's just not going to survive. And so the stock price had been sliding for years. You know, even a couple of years ago, it was down to like the $3.30 range. And then this week, it just skyrocketed. And I think on Thursday, it hit $492. And so that's why we're talking about it, is this battle between retail investors and institutional investors. I would say the one clarification I would give is that the institutional investors are the hedge funds, so the ones who are placing these bets on the downside, the ones who are betting that the price would go down, and then the retail investors betting that the price would go up, and in this crazy tug of war, and I would say this week the retail investors won.
All right, so explain. Let's jump back into that. So we got a couple minutes here before news, and we'll have to stop for in a few minutes and go to the news, but as best you can, and we'll continue after news if we need to. Explain to me the idea of short selling, or that they're betting against. So I know that if I'm interested, I think, oh, Apple's a good buy. I'm going to buy Apple stock. So I buy, say, one share of Apple stock. Say it was at $100. Okay, so I've got my $100 share of Apple stock. If that stock goes down in value, I have less value in it. If it goes way up, I have more value in it. But it's mine until I sell it. But when they're doing these short sales and they're betting against it, it's not just that their value is worth less and less, right? It's something they eventually have to cover. Like, they have to pony up them. And that's right. Is that part of the reason why these guys are so driving this price up now? Because they're sticking it to these hedge funds who don't just like, oh, that's, we lost money on that. It's they're going to have to actually, they're not just holding worthless pieces of paper. They actually have to pay out now. And like, that's why they're borrowing money and stuff, because they're going to come up short in these bets that they made. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yes. Yeah. No, I think you did a great job. So, you know, we typically think of buying stocks, and the idea is buy low, sell high.
Right.
That's how you make money. But shorting stocks is basically flipping that around, where the idea is you borrow the stock and you sell it at a high price, and then you buy it later at a low price and then return those stocks. And so then you're making money not on prices going up, but on prices going down. And then, like you said, you have to eventually buy the stock in order to repay the borrowed shares. And what's fascinating about this is, if you can force the price up, then the hedge fund has to buy those shares back at a loss. But in buying the shares back, it's actually pushing the price up further. And so, it's like this crazy feedback mechanism.
So what happens is, and I read about this guy who it's really affecting. I think it's the guy that runs Melvin, right? Because I've read about a couple other ones in this New York Times article, but another one I saw, because Ken Griffin here in Illinois had to help prop him up. This guy used to work, I believe, at Citadel. And so Ken Griffin, another guy, I think the owner of the Mets, right, Steve Cohen, they put in a couple billions to help cover him. And then the next day, the Robinhood app, where a lot of this has been done, shuts down trading on GameStop. Now, I read in one place that one of those hedge funds has some sort of stake in the Robinhood app, and maybe that's why it was shut down, and this is real nefarious. I've read other people tweeting that Robinhood couldn't cover what was happening here, and so that's why they had to shut it down. What's going on with why that was stopped? And you know, AOC and other politicians were raising alarms at why that happened, because, you know, when the little guy gets screwed, nobody's helping him, the theory is. But when Wall Street gets screwed, everybody stops what's going on and says, no, we can't let that happen. What happened there?
Yeah, so Robinhood is another fascinating player in this story, because, you know, like many of my students, they're getting into trading using Robinhood because it's this mobile-based app for stock trading without any transaction fees. And what happened was, you know, many people were buying GameStop or GME shares on Robinhood, but then as the prices became so volatile, that Robinhood decided to stop allowing you to buy shares on its platform. There's different reasons that have been given for that. I'm not totally in agreement with some of the more conspiracy stories. I do think that, you know, Robinhood faced some risk in the clearing process of, you know, when you're trying to close out transactions and prices are all over the place, it can pose some risk for a brokerage like that. So, you know, they did have to raise additional money in order to reopen trading. And, you know, I think it's understandable what Robinhood did from a monetary perspective, but from a social perspective, which is why AOC is getting involved and other politicians, you know, to have a trading app close down access to the public during this type of episode really does not look good, because you have this story of retail investors versus institutional, and it really seemed like that it was favoring the Wall Street side of the bet. And Citadel is here in Chicago, the fund run by Ken Griffin, as you were saying. They are the ones executing the majority of the trades for Robinhood. You know, they pay for that order flow from Robinhood. And so it puts Citadel in this very awkward position, you know, now that they're also the ones who are bailing out Melvin Capital. So so it's unclear as to who was on which side.
And on a night moves, trying to make some front page driving news. Working on a night moves in the summertime.
.1209, Sweet Summertime is coming back sometime soon, but for this weekend, they're saying overnight, Saturday night into Sunday morning and Sunday afternoon, up to possibly 12 inches of snow, maybe, looks like at least 5 to 7 in the whole listening area, at least in this northern central part of Chicago and west of the city, and ice further south, so it's a get to the grocery store day on Saturday and get things ready. Brennan's giving me the thumbs down on that snow, but I'll tell you what, my son Tommy, who runs Tommy Bubala's Landscaping, and he's got snow removal contracts. Tommy is a little entrepreneur. Tommy has more money in his bank account right now than I do. And not that that's any great shakes, but for a kid of 15, he's banking it.
He's probably got more than I do, too.
Probably. I'll tell you right now, he makes more than you make as a producer. I'll guarantee that. Because I used to sit on that side of the glass, and I remember. He's just about making more than I am. And if we get more than 5 inches, I guarantee you this weekend he's making more than that. He's got contracts with people. 1 to 4 inches, $20. 5 to 8 inches, $40.
Wow. All right. He's a little go-getter.
Last weekend when we had the snow, he made $130.
That's amazing.
Jeez.
Good for him.
These kids. And now he's going to, you know, blow up GameStop or something and, you know, make all his millions that way. At least I hope he is. Lamont Black is, by the way, in the news, any of you that were listening, paying attention during the news, you hit the weather, we hit the weather sounder, and it starts to play, and then it stops dead. Because Steve Ruxton just had a little hiccup. You know, we got a lot of technology here. Sometimes things go wrong. If you all could see Brennan and I shoot up like rockets, like, oh my God, what's wrong? Jump on the air. Let's ring. There's nothing like at a radio station when suddenly during a newscast or something where the regular people aren't like participating, when there's dead air, how we all just like, it's like we just suddenly took a shot of something. Like we just sit up like, oh my God, there's dead air.
It's like when like someone sees like a predator in like the woods and you're just like, yeah. And you like shoot up out of nowhere.
We're ready to start hitting buttons, saying things. We don't know what to do. Brent and I sit up and look at each other like, blah, blah, blah. And then Steve, you know, moved on and it was fine. But that 1 second where it's like you realize the serial killer is in your house and you sit up straight, like, what are we going to do? That's what happens at a radio station when something goes dead for just a second. Our friend Lamont Black is an associate professor in the College of Business at DePaul University here. He's also the academic director for the Center of Financial Services. And his students are joining the Robinhood app like crazy, no doubt. My son, who's a sophomore at Nebraska, I had never heard of this, Lamont, until earlier this year. My son at Nebraska is doing little $5 trades all the time on the Robinhood app. And what I don't understand is there's no fees. How does that work for the Robinhood app? Where are they making their money?
Well, it actually picks up where we were talking about with Citadel. So Citadel is paying Robinhood for those orders, payment for order flow. And so they're basically not getting paid by the users. They're getting paid by the market maker that they're sending the orders to.
Okay, I still don't understand that. If I'm buying a stock and I'm not paying a service fee to Robinhood, why is Citadel paying a service fee to Robinhood? How does Citadel make money on that then?
So Citadel is a market maker, and so by executing those trades, the Citadel makes a small cut of that transaction. And so if they get more order flow, then they can make more of those market-making fees. And this is what gets into another issue that Robinhood is facing. So they're currently under investigation for this very practice because in the stock market, there's this regulatory policy of best execution. So there's different market makers that you can send these orders to in order to execute on the exchanges, like the New York Stock Exchange. And the idea is that you should look for the market maker offering the best available opportunity and send it to that market maker But when you have a business model where you're getting paid to send it to a particular market maker, then you're not offering best execution. And so Robinhood's actually being fined for that as well. So they're in trouble for a couple of reasons.
So let me understand that. So when I'm buying a stock, so say let's go back to my Apple stock at $100 a share. I'm going to buy a share of that. And so I send that in. Well, that really... the price ends up being whatever that gets executed at. So when the trade actually goes through. So when I make that, so I have Fidelity. When I tell Fidelity I want to buy my one share, they're sending it through to get me the best, quickest price they can, or the quickest execution, I imagine, at whatever that price is. But you're saying when I do it through Robinhood, it's going to Citadel, and whenever they get it done, it's going to be at whatever price they got it done at.
That's right, which may not be the lowest price.
Right.
And so even though you're saving money on the commission side, you might not be getting as good of a deal on the execution side.
But explain to me, so by making that, they're making money off executing it, so the exchange is paying them a fee? Like, who is actually paying them the money?
Well, there's something in the stock market called the bid-ask spread. And so when you're buying and selling stocks, it's not like there's directly the buyer and the seller transacting. There's typically a market maker who's sort of functioning as this middleman in the transaction. And so they earn the bid-ask spread, which is the difference between the buy price and the sell price. And so, you know, they're sort of, it's a component of the sale price that they're earning.
So when I buy my stock for $1 and it tells me I have one share of Apple and it's worth $100 and that's what I spent, the person I bought that share from might have only gotten $99.95, something like that.
Right.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so there's a gap. And you know, Citadel, this is one of their key businesses, and you know, that they're basically what's called providing liquidity to the market so that you have this ability to buy and sell very quickly and relatively cheaply. I mean, the stock market is a very liquid financial market, but whenever you have orders being directed towards one market maker, that raises some questions about the competitiveness of the stock market and the order flow.
So when you see what happened here with GameStop, because GameStop's not the only one, right? AMC, and there's a couple other. It was kind of like going back to my childhood, a couple of the companies that whose money went through the roof last week. Is this just a bunch of, I mean, it's almost like, is this like a bunch of kids screwing around and messing with the market? Or are these people, like, it sounds like this this guy that goes by, what is the stupid name he goes by? Roaring Kitty. It sounds like Roaring Kitty really believes in GameStop. At least he acts like, no, they're going to sell more games. This is going to have whatever. Even though everything else says it's not. And then all these people buy into it and it goes up. But then there's other stocks that they're kind of doing this with too. Is it really that they truly believe more than everybody else that there's something to this? Or are they just trying to mess now with some of these hedge funds that were betting against these stocks?
Yeah, when I first heard about this and it started becoming like a thing this week, I did think of it as more kind of like a difference of long-term value proposition, like one side thinking that GameStop really does have a future, one side thinking that it doesn't. But all of these companies, like you mentioned, AMC, Express, BlackBerry, Bed Bath & Beyond, what the common factor here is the large short interest. So all of these stocks have a huge amount of short positions on them. And so this, what we're seeing now with Reddit and the retail investors, I think is actually a brilliant strategy, which isn't necessarily long-term. It can be quite short-term, which is if they can identify which of these stocks have a high short interest, this information is publicly available on the web, and if they can coordinate with other retail investors and incentivize this buying across the retail investors, they can create enough critical mass to push the price up. And in doing so, they are what you referred to earlier, squeezing the shorts, which then forces the short sellers to buy those shares back in order to cover their short position. And in buying those shares back, the short sellers are then pushing the price up even further. And so basically, it's a strategic move, not necessarily like a philosophical difference. It is a strategic move of, if we have enough buying pressure, we can force the short sellers to cover, which will force the price higher, and we'll make money.
Well,
so this, but, you know, I think there is this idea of like, stick it to the man. We need to do this together. But ultimately, it's a way to make money.
But is it though? Because what happens eventually, I imagine, so they make them do the short sales, which is going to prop it up even further. But you don't make anything until you actually sell it. And if everybody then, you know, how are they going to do this when they decide to sell? It's going to start dropping, I would imagine, dramatically. And then some people, like, for example, these guys that bought and are holding, fine. But the price keeps going up because people keep buying in. So now they're buying in at probably a ridiculous price. A stock that, you know, a year or two ago was at $3 or $4, that's now at $235, that does not have any better prospects than it did. It's just these guys are pushing against the hedge funds. That's like a false positive, right? So once everybody decides to sell, I imagine it's suddenly the Titanic, and there's going to be people who bought it at $200, $235, thought this was great, who aren't going to get out in time, or who are going to get screwed in the end. I mean, somebody's going to lose a bunch of money besides the hedge funds in this, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, this is, I would describe it as like a dangerous game. You know, they are basically forcing the hand of the hedge funds, which drives the price higher. But as you said, there is a limit to this. And so the skill and the art of day trading is, how do you know when to pull your money off the table? I mean, this is pure speculation. You're right. GameStop, the outlook isn't any more positive than it was a week ago. It's simply this strategic play of retail versus institutional. And if you get the timing right, you make a ton of money. But if you hold it a little too long, then you might lose everything that you gain. Because, you know, stocks can have great value on paper, but until you hit the sell button, it's not actually converted back into cash. And so I think within the retail space, there's going to be smart money and what some people call dumb money, where some people... There's terrible stories out there now of people putting their retirement savings into these companies to try and make a quick return. But that's any get-rich-quick strategy. You know, you're going to have people who join the bandwagon too late and they lose everything. But I think some of these folks on Reddit, they know exactly what they're doing, and they're going to push it as far as they can, and then they're going to pull the parachute.
What's your guess on how many people this is that have gotten, you know, game? So according to the New York Times, GameStop traded at $4 a year ago, closed Friday at $325 a share. How many people must there be in this retail space doing this to get something to lift that much? Is it 100,000? Does it have 2 million, 3 million? How many people must be buying this, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on how big those positions are. So you mentioned like this guy Roaring Kitty. So his name's Keith Gill,
yeah.
And you know, the Wall Street Journal just did a big interview with him. I mean, he has a very large position. So this isn't, when you say retail, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, people putting in a few hundred dollars here and
right.
there.
Well, so let's talk about that, because he put in $53,000. But that's like a year and a half ago. And this is a guy who's got a bunch of money, it sounds like. He trades and he has money. So he's willing to stick this out and not sell yet. But wouldn't you imagine that a lot of people investing on here are just putting in $1,000 or $2,000? Or do you think it's a bunch of people putting in like $50,000 and $100,000, people that really have money to play with?
No, I think you're right. It's primarily the small dollar amounts. I mean, I asked my students this week whether any of them were in on GameStop, and some of them are. So, you know, there's people all over the country that are getting in on this. And I think part of what's fascinating about this is, historically, there was this idea that you can't beat Wall Street, that Wall Street, the hedge funds, are simply too big. And if you think about this as like buying pressure versus selling pressure, size matters. You know, if you have big enough players putting downward pressure on the price by short selling, then they're going to overpower any amount of retail investors if those retail investors just don't add up to enough buying pressure. And so the big dominates the small. And so that's the real storyline this week, I think, is with Reddit, with social media, the internet is changing the nature of retail investing, where now we have the ability to coordinate and the ability to move en masse in a way that can scale up to compete with the hedge funds. And so, there's a lot of this talk of like David versus Goliath, and I think it's pretty cool. You know, I was a little skeptical when I first heard about this, because like you were saying, you know, this price movement we're seeing, it's pure speculation. And there's a lot of stories like in cryptocurrency of this thing called pump and dump, where, you know, you get somebody on the web and they say, you know, you got to buy this particular coin because this is going to, you know, it's the new hot thing. And then they turn around and then they sell it once it has that spike. So I'm sure there's some of the folks on Reddit who are playing that same type of game. But I do think that, you know, there is this democratization of finance that we're seeing, and it is a power of social media that's not just changing politics and other types of, our society. It's changing the world of investing.
I have to imagine, though, that what we're going to see in a few weeks is these people that made an insane amount, at some point, they're going to think, I got to sell this. And so that wave will come. The sell will happen, especially if Roaring Kitty decides to sell off, all his followers will think, okay, it's time to pull. And then we're going to hear the stories of the people that went ahead and bought in at $200 or $210 and spent, you know, their savings or whatever it was, thinking this is the next thing. And we're going to hear these stories about how they lost everything.
I totally agree with you, but I don't think that makes all of this a bad idea. You know, there's actually like this social debate now about, is this market manipulation? Are guys like Keith Gill sort of creating this fan base, which he's then kind of using to his own purposes to better his own portfolio? But, you know, I'm kind of sympathetic to the idea that this is freedom of speech. You know, if somebody believes in an idea and they want to support that idea and get others to join them, I think that's, you can't put wrong information out there. That's clearly illegal. That's market manipulation. But this is about, you know, social influencers in the investing space. And I think we're going to see more and more of this, just like we've seen with Instagram and the nature of marketing. It's moved towards individuals who are getting other people to follow them. And I think it's an interesting development that can really, I think, start to put Wall Street on its heels and potentially create a balance of power, which might be healthy for the market.
You say, you know, is this market manipulation? I imagine that on the other side, there has been some legalized form of market manipulation for time immemorial. I mean, it's always been that way towards the big guy, right? There's always ways that they are recommending doing things that are tilting things in their favor. So this might be, like you said, a little bit of an evening out of the playing field.
Exactly. You know, there's been a lot of the comments from Wall Street and the institutional side saying, you know, this isn't legal, this isn't fair. But, you know, I think, like you said, they have their ways of doing it. And so if we can see more of this, that may actually be in a more transparent and, visible manner, where, you know, Reddit, anybody can sign on and they can see what these people are saying, then I think we might get a market where you get more transparency of the positions that are being taken. And I, you know, I'm seeing my students getting excited about the market again.
Yeah.
And so they don't feel like it's something that they just can't control, that's going to continually push them around. They start to feel like, this is something where I can participate.
There's been a really interesting backlash online of people writing, you know, that the the rich always say, well, you should save up. You shouldn't spend so much. You shouldn't have an iPhone if you're broke, things like that. And so people are tweeting things like, you know, you don't understand. There are people out there that have boats to pay for and they're being hurt by this. Or there are people with secret families that they can't support. I mean, it's really kind of amusing what people are writing. But Lamont, here's what I'm picturing. And I want to know what happens. So next week, you're getting ready to teach class and some kid comes in looking like Leo in Wolf of Wall Street and he waltzes in, sits down. And you look at him, he says, well, I just cashed out my GameStop for $2.4 million. Do you just hand him the chalk then and tell him to teach a class and you sit and look at your 401k and cry a little? Or what happens then?
Well, you know, I really, it has challenged me because I'm a very much like diversification, buy and hold, yeah, long-term strategy. And I've got these students now.
You're driving an Oldsmobile.
Money. You were talking about your son, Tommy. You know, I'm talking about that with my students, being like, dude, that kid just made more money than I did. Maybe I need to learn something from him.
I know. Oh, man. You and I are driving around Oldsmobiles like, no, buy and hold. Get something with a good, steady return every year. You just build it up. You'll see. And they're like, okay, pops, that's what we'll do. Lamont Black is an associate professor of finance in the Dry House College of Business at DePaul University in Chicago and a great guest. I really appreciate the time tonight. Until next week and whatever the world throws at us next, have a great weekend, okay?
Sounds good. You too.
All right. Thank you, Lamont.